Have a seat. We're in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. We shall start first with a video.
Dear Dad, after all these years, I've never stopped writing. I still remember many of the letters I've written you, and the moments I wish you could have seen.
Dear Daddy, I'm sad you had to leave, but I'm trying real hard to remember that you told me you'll always love me and to write you all the time. I didn't want you to go, but you pulled me close and hugged me tight, and you said that some things are worth fighting for.
Dear Daddy, I learned how to roller skate today. You'd be so proud. I fell down sometimes and skinned my knees, so I tried again and again. I was brave just like you.
Hey, Dad. Sorry I haven't ridden in a while. I'm 14 today. Can you believe it? Don't worry, though. No boyfriends. Mom and I are doing well. Sometimes we get lonely, but it's not too bad. Dear Dad, high school graduation. I really wish you were here today. College is just around the corner. I'm staying close to home, though. I figured you'd want me to help keep an eye on Mom. Dear Dad, today I married the man of my dreams. He reminds me of you. He's gentle, yet strong. He loves serving me, and he can make me laugh all the time, just like you could. Granddaddy went ahead and walked me down the aisle, said that you'd be proud of me. It was a wonderful day seeing so many friends. We talked about you a lot, and how we wished you were here. Oh, Daddy, I love coming to visit you. This time, I brought someone else. Your granddaughter. I tell her about you all the time. We talk about the letters I write you and that maybe she can write you too someday. Yesterday, she told me she'd love to meet you. So I pulled her close, hugged her tight, and told her about how some things in this world are worth fighting for, even dying for. Love always, your daughter.
The holiday this weekend isn't just about the start of summer. We call it Memorial Day to remember. So I encourage you, friends, don't forget. Don't forget what this is about. We live in a blessed country, don't we? It didn't get that way for nothing, because men and women gave their lives for us. And I encourage you to take some time to think about that. We're in Daniel chapter 7. We're now crossing into a new section of the book. The first half of Daniel, the first six chapters, give us a historical account of Daniel's time in Babylon. This second half now, starting in chapter 7, We cross into the prophecies of Daniel, the prophetic, the looking to the future. And so that's where we are. Daniel's going to look a little different than it did the last 6 weeks. We're no more fun, cool story. Now we get into the nitty gritty, difficult and fascinating things of prophecy. Starting in chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea each different from the other. So Daniel has this vision, and he sees four great beasts. We're going to see that Daniel's dream, his vision, parallels the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had back in Daniel chapter 2. So those of you who were around when we studied Daniel chapter 2, you're going to say, well, this sounds awfully familiar. It ought to, because you can lay them on top of each other and you see the parallels. Nebuchadnezzar saw a statue made of four kinds of materials, which represented four empires, four kingdoms. This dream is not about a single statue with different materials. This one is about four different beasts, but it's the same concept, that there are four empires in view. When he sees these beasts, they're coming out, it says in verse 2, out of the great sea. And typically, usually, this refers to, in Scripture, of the Mediterranean. So these four empires are going to be empires that touch, at some point, the Mediterranean Sea. Verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. The first was like a lion. Just like Nebuchadnezzar's dream, this first empire is about Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian empire. Lions and eagles are all woven into Babylonian artwork. Even this one right here, was found on the Ishtar Gate in Babylon, this winged lion. This is not an unusual connection to Babylon. When it talks about wings being plucked off, about it standing on 2 feet like a man and a man's heart, it seems to remind us of what we studied in Daniel chapter 4, when Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, where he spent a bit of time in the psych ward acting like a cow. Humbled until the day that he looked up and realized that there was a God in heaven. And so he's kind of talking about these things. Verse 5. And suddenly, another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. The second empire, like a bear. We know this is the Medo-Persian Empire. Because Daniel dates this as the first year of Belshazzar, we know that this actually, the Medo-Persian Empire, won't come into power for 14 more years. We've kind of backstepped from where we were last week. Last week, we were already in the reign of the Persians. Now he'd already dated this as being the first year of Belshazzar instead of the last year of Belshazzar, which was the last chapter. This bear is raised up on one side. That's because the Persian Empire, the Persian part of the Medo-Persians, the Persian part was bigger, it was greater. It says it's got three ribs in its mouth. Now, some suggest that maybe it's talking about the nations that Persia conquered to form their empire. It might just mean they like barbecue. Anybody feel like Lucille's afterwards? Yeah, get me some ribs. Okay, sorry. Verse 6. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. A leopard with wings. This is a picture of speed. Leopards are just a little bit faster than lions, you know. And having wings, that makes it even faster. And this is a picture of the Greeks, in particular of Alexander the Great. He was a young man. And he conquered the world in 4 years. Even in today's standards, that's quick. It says this leopard has four heads. Alexander died at an early age, and his empire was divided. It was still the Greek Empire, but it was divided into four parts, divided among his four generals. So that's what this is talking about. Verse 7. We're not spending a lot of time on these first three because Daniel doesn't spend a lot of time on these first three. So verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, this fourth beast, dreadful and terrible. This is the Roman Empire. We saw this back from Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. The Romans crushed the world with their armies. And unlike the other empires, this one, it's no known animal is associated with the empire. Now, I found all kinds of cool drawings. People tended to do dinosaurs with it. So I don't know if it's dinosaurs or what. I don't know. But Daniel doesn't tell us what, so we won't try to make too much of it. This thing has huge iron teeth. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, remember the part representing the Roman Empire, legs of iron. Legs of iron. Same. That's kind of fascinating. You see the connection. You'll see these two dreams tying with each other. It says that there was a horn, another horn, a little one. We'll get the details of this later as we get through the chapter, because it's going to be explained to Daniel. But let me just say that this little horn is the Antichrist. This little horn is the Antichrist. We pick it up in verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. Ancient of Days, this, my friends, is God the Father. This is God the Father, the Ancient of Days. He's described in human terms as if he's got white hair. The idea is that he's been around quite a while. Psalm 90 says, verse 2, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you were God. God is really, really old. We still have a few young folks in church this morning, and you think your parents are old? You got nothing on God. God is really, really, really old. And his age, sometimes we think of age as being fragile, weak. No, this is about wisdom, about his ability to judge. He is wise and he is good in judgment. It talks about God's throne, flames, wheels, the same images that Ezekiel sees in Ezekiel chapter 1. Same picture exactly. God sitting on a throne with wheels and fire, and the goofy people say it's all UFOs. That's goofy stuff. This is the throne of God. And Daniel sees the same imagery as he's watching in his dream. Verse 10, a fiery stream issued. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 1,000 times 1,000 is what? It's 1,000,000. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Anybody want to guess 10,000 times 10,000? That's like 100,000,000, I think, something like that. The court was seated and the books were opened. The court was seated. This is a picture of judgment. What we're going to see over these next couple verses. Has anybody ever been in court? Come on, I'm not going to ask you whether you're being convicted or anything. You could be doing jury duty, okay? Have you ever been in jury duty? Okay, raise your hand willingly, okay. Take a picture, we know who's guilty in here. The court was seated. The books were opened. My friends, God will judge one day. God will one day judge the world. He has the right to judge because he's our creator. He is our maker. that gives him the right to judge. Sometimes we say, who do you think you are? You can't be the judge of me. You know what? You'll never say that to God. Because he's your maker. He's your God. He's your creator. He has the right to judge. The psalmist writes in Psalm 96, for he is coming, to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. He has the right to judge. And he is a good judge. He is a good judge. I have a new appreciation for our legal system right now. I have a new appreciation for those who work in law enforcement, in the court system. Even though I am well aware that our court system, our legal system, isn't perfect. A defendant in a lawsuit involving large sums of money was saying to his lawyer, if I lose this case, I'll be ruined. It's in the judge's hands now, said the lawyer. Well, would it help if I sent the judge a box of cigars? Asked the defendant. No, said the lawyer. This judge is a stickler for ethical behavior. A stunt like that would prejudice him against you. He might even find you in contempt of court. In fact, you shouldn't even smile at the judge. Well, within the course of time, the judge ruled in favor of the defendant. And as the defendant left the courthouse, he said to his lawyer, thanks for the tip about the cigars. It worked. Well, I'm sure we would have lost the case if you'd sent them, said the lawyer. But I did send them, said the defendant. What? You did? Yes, that's how we won the case. I don't understand, said the lawyer. Well, it's easy, he said. I sent the cheapest box of cigars I could find to the judge and enclosed the plaintiff's card on them. You gave me a much nicer laugh than the first service. First service, it was like crickets in here. It's like, it's bad, bad. When the angels in heaven who have front row seats to the events on earth and they're watching God judge, this is how they respond. And I heard another from the altar saying, even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are your judgments. Oh God, you do such a good job. You get every call right. You get every call right. He's a good judge. And he judges with, well, in court terms, they call it clear and convincing evidence. He judges with evidence. God's judgment isn't based on what kind of mood he's in or whether you send him cigars. When you face him, his judgment will be based on the record, on the evidence. It says the books were opened. The books were opened. I think that seems to indicate that there are records in heaven of what goes on this planet. It might be scrolls. It could be. Maybe that's the way it was. It is, you know. It could be scrolls. It could be videotape. I kind of think it's one better. I kind of think it's probably not just, oh, these are like idiots getting to do with it. This is like the stupidest crimes of the century. This guy, you know, robbed somebody and then he drops all his money at the door. Yeah. And then the next little video clip is some idiot who's trying to steal a box, a carton of cigarettes, and he's trying to watch him try to stuff it in his jacket. But it's all being caught on videotape. Well, in heaven, gang, there are records. There is evidence. And I kind of have this feeling the records don't just include video or audio. Here's a guy that's going to rob somebody and then he can't get out the door. It's just hilarious. It's hilarious. I think in heaven, I'll bet the records even have our, but the, in heaven, okay, I gotta watch, let you watch this guy. I've just lost your attention. He never thinks about using the fire extinguisher, but he gets through the door. I'll bet in heaven, the records even include your thoughts. It's clear record. It's evidence in heaven. You know, some people like to make up stories and lie to everybody. And some of us believe all the lies. Some of us have a hard time telling the truth from the lies. And so I just believe everything everybody tells me. You know what? I got news for you. If you think you're going to do that with God, good luck. Because he'll pull out the record. And he'll say, you're kidding. Would you lie? I'll give you one more chance to clear up the record. It's based on evidence. You can't blow smoke in God's face. He sees everything. Clear and convincing evidence. Are you ready for court? Are you ready for your court date? Jesus tells a story. He says, Luke 12, it says, verse 16, he spoke a parable to them saying, the ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully, and he thought within himself saying, what shall I do since I have no room to store my crops? So he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater barns, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. You might be thinking to yourself, well, you know, I'll figure it out. You know, when I'm on my deathbed, I'll turn it around. I got news for you. You have no guarantee that you will ever know when your deathbed will come. Your deathbed could come tonight. It might come in 50 years. You have no guarantee of when it's going to come. And there will be a day when you will stand before your God. Will you know what to do? But I was going to turn around one day. That's too late. Too late. The Bible says it's appointed to man once to die, and then comes judgment. There's only one way to prepare to stand before the judge. First, I got to tell you, you got to get yourself a good attorney. You need a good attorney. I'm finding that out. Anybody who goes to court without an attorney is an idiot. Because, man, they know stuff that us idiots don't. And Jesus, 1 John chapter 2, is our defense attorney. And he not only knows how to handle things in court, he not only comes to defend us, my goodness, friends, he came to pay the penalty for us. That's why he came to die. He died in my place so I wouldn't have to face the penalty. And John writes, he who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. Are you ready to face the judge? There's one way you can be ready. You turn around and you ask God for help. You turn around and ask God to forgive you. And you'll be ready. You'll be ready. Verse 11, back to our text. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. Remember back in, I think it was verse 8, this horn was speaking pompous words. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. The sound of pompous words. When you're in court, there will be a point where the bailiff will show up, or somebody, or the court clerk, and they'll call the court to order. And I have news for you. At that point, you had better shut your trap. Because if you don't, you will be in trouble. Some bailiffs will give you, you know, a minute to figure it out. Some won't. And you'll be in trouble. The court is called to order. But everybody hears the sound of these pompous words. Instead of silence, all they hear is blasphemy being spoken by this horn with the eyes in the mouth. Pompous words. Verse 11, and I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. The Antichrist will meet his end when Jesus returns. And Jesus will throw the Antichrist alive into the lake of fire. Revelation 19:20. Verse 12. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. One coming like the Son of Man. Okay, Sunday school class, here it comes. Who is this talking about? Good job, Sunday school class. It is talking about Jesus. You get an A. When he returns, it says he will return with the clouds. Now, this might actually be white puffer cumulus kind of clouds. When Jesus ascended in Acts chapter 1, when he ascended, after rising from the dead, he ascended into heaven. It says he went up, got taken up into a cloud, and two angels showed up and told the disciples to close their mouths because their mouths were going... And they said, you know what? He's going to come back just like he left, which we think may refer to clouds. So it could be talking about actual white clouds. It may refer to the armies of heaven. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 talks about us being surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, a cloud of people. Revelation tells us that when Jesus returns, the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now, if a whole bunch of people are riding white horses and they've got white robes and they're all together, it could look like a cloud. You know, that could work, you know, if they're flying and stuff like that. Won't that be fun? By the way, that's us. Go get your horse lessons. Go get training on your horses so you won't be scared of riding the horses, you know, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Now remember, he's in a dream, he's in a vision, and he's finding himself in heaven. And heaven surrounded with, remember, millions of people. So he talks to one of the bystanders, could be an angel, could be one of us, who knows. And he asks this individual, what's going on here? Verse 17. Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, which before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, here's the reply, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. Another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. It says the 10 horns are 10 kings. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, back in Daniel 2, we saw that We discussed this in depth, so I'm not going to take a lot of time to give you my reasons for this. But we saw back then that there are two forms of the Roman Empire, an ancient form and what we believe is a future yet to come form. And remember this statue had toes. How many toes do most people have? 10. Just like 10 kings, 10 horns. Coincidence, huh? Fascinating. That's not a coincidence. We stated back then that we believe that this future Antichrist kingdom will be something similar to a revived Roman Empire. Perhaps it's something that covers Europe. Maybe something like that. I believe that these 10 horns are part of this future form of the Roman Empire. I believe that they speak to the future, especially when we get to the Antichrist being involved. The 10 kings might be 10 rulers, because it mentions here as 10 kings, but you will see as you go through Scripture, as you study Scripture, and you study the symbolism, like here and in, like, for example, Revelation 17, you will see that kings and their kingdoms are used interchangeably. So whether it's 10 rulers or actually 10 nations, I wouldn't get sold on one or the other. Could be one or the other. Could be a confederation of 10 states. Could be a confederation of 10 nations. And it says another, verse 24, another shall rise after them. Again, this is the Antichrist. He apparently conquers either 3 rulers or 3 countries. He will take out 3 of whatever they are, 3 of the horns. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Now, this horn, the Antichrist, says he shall speak pompous words. This is still in Aramaic, and the word is not actually in verse 25. Pompous is actually a couple of times we've already read the word. It's already appeared in a few of the previous verses. But the word pompous is in the Aramaic, rab-rab, R-A-B-R-A-B. It comes from the word rab for means great. The word rabbi comes from that, which means my great one, my teacher. Rab-rab, great, great. They're translating it here, pompous, great words. During World War II, the two main leaders that collided, that were at the center of everything, Adolf Hitler and Winston Churchill. I didn't throw in Roosevelt because he's a latecomer to the game. He turned the tides, but the war was between these two. Both men knew the power of words. Both men were able to inspire and direct their nations by words. The one on the left, I don't know if you've ever seen this old footage of Hitler stirring up the crowd, speaking before his people, stirring up his nation to do horrendous things, lying to his people, and stirring them up to do great evil. Churchill saw this. He read the translations of Hitler's speeches. And he was a man who was quite schooled in language, in the English language. And he used his words to inspire the rest of the world to stand up against this evil. And even when things got down to very, very small last shred of hope, he kept Britain going. And he eventually brought the rest of the world in to fight against this evil. The Antichrist will be a great communicator. He will speak pompous words, great words. And his language will be aimed against God himself. Pompous words against the Most High. It says he shall persecute the saints. Now, in our New Testament mindset, we usually think of saints as being the church, Christians. This is Old Testament, gang. And saints is also used to describe the nation of Israel. And I believe that that's what this is about. He shall persecute Israel, the Jews. During the 7-year tribulation period, the Antichrist will unleash great persecution against the Jews. You see this in Revelation 13:7. We saw in World War II, again, just a taste of foreshadowing of what was to come. When scattered reports escaped the Nazi propaganda machine, and they would get a few reports out to England and other places about Hitler slaughtering the Jews, it was too fast, it was too monstrous to believe. Nobody would believe that anybody would do such a horrendous thing. 6 million Jews slaughtered. I think the rest of the war did was close to that as well. But these weren't fighting people. These were people captured and put into slavery and then killed. And you know what, friends? That's just a shadow of what the Antichrist will attempt. He shall persecute the saints. Today, friends, you see a rise around the world of anti-Semitism. You will see this rising up even in England itself. You see it, you will see it in the United States. You see it in various nations around the world where people are talking about those Jews. When the president of Iran talks about promising to wipe Israel off the map, you know what? He's got an audience. I'm not saying he's the Antichrist. I think he's just a stupid fool. He doesn't fit a lot of the pictures. But this is all part of what's coming in the future. Terrible times. He shall persecute the saints. In verse 25 it says, he shall change times and law. This was something that Daniel in chapter 2 had attributed to God. Daniel 2:21, we saw this back in chapter 2. It says, this is talking about God. He changes the times and the seasons. That's the same language that's used here. God changes times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Now, some have suggested that this changing of times and law could be everything from new rules about daylight savings time to changing the sacrifices in the temple, which it could be these things. But keep in mind, in Daniel's own book, he's used this language to talk about something that belongs to God, something that is in God's purview. And perhaps, again, this is a hint that the Antichrist is trying to act like God. He's trying to control his world. It says that the persecution would come for a time and times and half a time. Now, if you take the word that's translated time, it refers to a period of time. And if you add it all up, you come up to 3.5 times. How, pray tell, do you get that? Well, because he says for one time, for times, which is two times. What's 1 + 2, by the way? This is upper math. I know this is confusing. What's 1 + 2? Oh, you're so good. You passed math, didn't you? And it says, and a half a time. And you add those all up and you get 3.5 times. Kind of fits the other scriptures that talk about this tribulation period being for 7 years. And in the middle of the tribulation period, it's like the Antichrist at the beginning of the tribulation, he rises to power. He's like the savior of the world. But in the middle of the tribulation period, an event called the Abomination of Desolation, which is when we'll see that when we get to chapter 9. We'll get into that more in detail. But it's kind of like he pulls off the mask and everybody sees how evil he is. Jesus said in Matthew 24, when you see the Abomination of Desolation standing in the holy place, head for the hills. And he's talking to his Jewish believer friends. Because from the abomination of desolation, that's when the great persecution is unleashed. Daniel calls it 3.5 times. Happens to fit, if you take 7 years, you divide it in half. What's half? And this is really complicated math. I'm really sorry to have to make your brain stress over this, but what's half of 7? Yeah, it is, isn't it? 3.5. Interesting how it all fits. Verse 26, but the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. A judgment is issued from the courtroom. The Antichrist's kingdom is done. God says, that's it, enough. Verse 27, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Now it says in verse 27 that the kingdom is given to the people, the saints of the Most High. This indeed can refer to Israel, but it goes beyond this in this time in history, because it includes you and I. We are people of the Most High. God's people will take part in God's kingdom when Jesus returns. Let me just wrap this up in a little bow like this. We win. We win. We win. You know, sometimes life gets pretty discouraging, doesn't it? You know, we go through battles and life sucks, doesn't it? We lose some of these battles, don't we? We wonder how long it's going to last. A few of us in this room are Angel fans. We like our team, the Angels, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. We do. We bleed Angel red. You know, we love the Angels. And last Christmas, we all got a great present. We were so excited when they signed. Yeah, and you've got your shirt on, don't you, buddy? All right, Jeremy, there you go. We're so excited when they signed Josh. Oh, my gosh, how exciting. But as you know, the season hasn't turned out the way we thought it would. Now, I know the last week has been awfully exciting. I mean, that's pretty exciting. You know, friends, we may not know whether or not the Angels will win the World Series this year, but I got to tell you, we know who wins the world. God does. We win. You may lose some battles for a while, but hang in there, friend. God wins the war. Sorry, I got to do one more World War II thing. Early in 1941, we, America, didn't enter the war all the way until December. We're so late coming into the war. We're like 2 years into the war. It's pathetic. But it's where we were as a nation. You know, nobody in the world wanted the war. That's why Hitler got his thing. That's why it got so far, because nobody would dare think that we'd go into another world war. And so they just gave him what he wanted, and he got bigger and bigger and bigger. Early in 1941, before we entered the war, President Roosevelt sent his closest friend and advisor, Harry Hopkins, to England. He was still bound by American law, which said, we don't want to be in the war. We ain't fighting this thing. But Roosevelt felt bad for what was going on. And so he wanted to help at some point. He came up with this, it's called the Lend-Lease Program, where we basically, the United States, would give all the materiel, food, weapons that the Allies could, well, that Britain, because at that point it was just Britain, give them everything that they need just to help them. We wouldn't send any soldiers, but we'll send them all the stuff. And so Hopkins was supposed to see if the British were worthy of receiving the kind of help that Roosevelt was proposing. Roosevelt had not met Churchill. Well, actually, they had met 20-some years ago, but very briefly. He didn't know what Churchill was really like, and he wanted to know. He wanted to know what kind of man Winston Spencer Churchill was like. So after spending a week with Churchill, this is what happened. That night, after dinner at the Station Hotel, Harry Hopkins lifted his glass in a toast that would become one of the most remembered toasts of the 20th century. Hopkins said, I suppose you wish to know, he began, what I'm going to say to President Roosevelt on my return. Well, I'm going to quote you one verse from that book of books. Whither thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. And he quietly added, even to the end. And if you follow the history, Britain was desperate at this point. They were desperate. And when Churchill heard this, he was in tears. Churchill's own doctor noted in his diary, it seemed like a rope thrown to a dying man. Well, my friends, when you're on God's side, you're not alone in the battle. Where you go, he'll go. He'll be with you. And yes, there may be some losing battles up ahead. But in the end, we win. We win. Not necessarily the World Series, but we will win the world. Because God wins. Let's stand and pray.